Coming up on this episode of Back in My Play, John Linneman from Digital Foundry Retro joins me to look back on one of the most important PC games of all time, Half-Life. We also get to talk a little bit about the ports, but it's really fascinating. Looking back on our discussion, we didn't mention the G-Man. I was thinking about him, but didn't mention him. It's kind of like he was always there in the background. Also, the Vortigaunts. Really interesting. We focused on some of the different enemy types, but didn't hit on those Vortigaunts either. But I think we'll be talking about them once we get to Half-Life 2. That's going to be coming up in the future, but I digress. Let's get right into the episode. Let's talk about some Half-Life. Hello, welcome back to Back in My Play. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and it's been a long time, but you know, we thought we'd boot up those PCs, those old Pentium 2s. Actually, you could probably even do a little bit worse than that to play our next game that we're going to be talking about today. Joining me to talk about the original Half-Life, we got John Linneman over from Digital Foundry and, of course, the great Digital Foundry Retro series. John, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful, Kevin. Thanks for having me today.
I figured you would be the perfect guest to talk about this stuff because one of the earliest DF Retro videos that you did was talking about the original Half-Life and like some of the crazy ports that, of course, we're going to bring up in this episode.
Yeah, of course. And I was there for Half-Life back on the PC on day one. So, you know, I've been playing Half-Life since it came out.
we're going to get all into that. This is an episode I've really wanted to do for a long, long time for multiple reasons that we'll get into. And it's kind of hard to believe that this is episode 119 and the first PC kind of game that we've really talked about on this show in terms of being like it launched on the PC and wasn't just like ported to the PC kind of thing.
Exactly.
So it'll be fun. It's about time. But before we get into that, just a couple quick things. You know, as always, thank you to the patience of the audience. Things are starting to be a little bit more regular in terms of my schedule. So hopefully Back My Play will be rather consistent going forward. I got, I think, 20 episodes outlined right now. Like I went really hard into putting together some detailed thoughts into some episodes, some guests, so we can make sure that it is consistent. So we will be hopefully rather regularly going forward. With that being said, even more so, very, very important and awesome to all the patrons out there. Patron support is really critical to the show. So if you do enjoy the show, help me continue to make it consistent by going to patreon.com/backmyplay. Patreons are going to get exclusive stuff. Like we're going to do an exclusive segment talking about the PlayStation 3, collecting for the PlayStation 3, the hardware, as that stuff kind of gets towards, I mean, it's at end of life, but we got to remember we're going to have to like save a lot of these digital games and like what games you should be looking to collect for the console before things get insanely expensive. So we'll get into that for the Patreon folks at the end. So stick around for that. And I think we'll just leave it right there. One of the great things about Half-Life is like the really awesome soundtrack, really underrated soundtrack that Half-Life has. So we're going to take a quick break. You're going to hear some music from that, and then we'll be right back with the history of Half-Life. So let's talk a little bit about the history of Half-Life. So again, I really recommend you go and check out John's DF Retro video. We'll put it in the show notes if you haven't seen it already, and go check out all the awesome videos in the series. But one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk about Half-Life is just because it has a really weird history, not just the series, but this game in particular. Let's start with its release. It came out November 19th, 1998. I will briefly mention at the top that there were a couple ports of this game, primarily on the PlayStation 2, which came out 3 years later, November 11th, and that was developed by Gearbox. But we will also talk about the infamous Dreamcast version, which was, of course, leaked in 2003. That was done by Captivation Digital Laboratories. We'll come back to that in a little bit. So, of course, the game was developed by Valve, published by Sierra. Man, I really miss Sierra. Sierra was putting out just some of like the cool, like Sierra was like the like awesome adventure PC game company back in the day. I just like remember seeing that logo for like half the games I played on the computer.
Yeah, and this was like the kind of the latter days of Sierra, I think. And oddly enough, I remember when I first bought my copy of Half-Life, I was with a friend that bought another Sierra game that had just come out, which was King's Quest VIII, The Mask of Eternity. Which, you know, it's history maybe hasn't been so kind to that one. But hey, you know, it was a double Sierra kind of moment.
Wait, so they made it to King's Quest VIII?
Yes. All right, so King's Quest VIII is actually the one that was inspired by Mario 64, of all things.
Oh, my God.
So it is a fully 3D adventure game set in the Kingdom of Daventry. And, you know, it's a very weird, kind of forgotten, very, very dark game. Like, it's not at all cheery, unlike the rest of the series. So it's really weird. But that was also, obviously, a Sierra game, though, you know, Half-Life kind of stole its thunder.
Well, this is... God, I mean, when I was doing some of the research for the show, just to briefly talk about Sierra, like I remember seeing that logo on tons of things. Like, of course, it was my I guess you would call him my great uncle. He had a Mac, so he had Space Quest. He had the Space Quest games on there, which were hilarious and like kind of oddly violent for kids back in the day because of how many, you know, different ways you could you could die. But I particularly remember it from the Castle of Dr. Brain. Have you ever played this game or seen this game?
Yes, I do actually remember that. It was like some sort of, it was kind of a graphic adventure, but more of a puzzle game kind of thing, I believe.
It was like a pack-in for our Packard Bell computer that we got like way back in the day. I can't remember if it was on our 386 or if it was on our Packard. Actually, it was probably on the 386. Yeah, if I'm thinking about it correctly. But... Again, just a really cool history. I'm sure we're going to be talking about some more Sierra games in the future. But like I was mentioning before, lots of history to talk about for Half-Life. So I'll try to brush by that and not get too deep. The composer was Kelly Bailey. We'll come back to Kelly. He did really all the soundtracks for the Half-Life games. And again, really, really underrated stuff. So this is the stuff that most people know. So... first off, Valve was founded in 96 by former Microsoft employees Mike Harrington and Gabe Newell. Like, this is well-treaded territory, but we're going to bring it up anyways. when they were putting together this game, they wanted to do something that would be like a huge leap forward in the first-person genre. You know, Gabe Newell specifically said, Half-Life in many ways was a reactionary response to the trivialization of the experience of the first-person genre. Many of us had fallen in love with video games because of the phenomenological possibilities of the field and felt like the industry was reducing the experience to the least common denominators rather than exploring those possibilities. Our hope was that building worlds and characters would be more compelling than building shooting galleries. I think he's taking a shot at Rise of the Triad. I don't like that. But
oh, man, you can't knock Rise of the Triad. Come on.
Come on. You know, those Gibbs, man. All right. So Valve struggled to find a publisher as they're in development, as many believe the game was too ambitious for the first time developer. But Sierra Online signed Valve for a one game deal as it was interested in making a 3D action game, especially one based on the Quake engine. So like you were saying, this is kind of latter day Sierra, and they didn't have a ton of heavy hitters in their own catalog. So it seemed like a pretty decent risk for them to sign Valve and to try to get into this whole first-person genre. They just didn't have a strong contender there.
Yeah, I mean, Sierra was kind of weird in the late 90s. They did still have some stuff coming out. I mean, they were the company that launched like Star Siege Tribes and Tribes 2, which was awesome. And, you know, Dr. Brain was still around. There was a bunch of racing games like Viper Racing. But Sierra was not the juggernaut it used to be. So I think, you know, at the time, a lot of companies were starting to invest in making first-person shooters, specifically using the Quake engine. That was like the thing to do. Everybody was doing it. So, you know, you had Daikatana, you had Sin, you know, you had Hexen 2 from Raven earlier on, which then the third-person Heretic 2. all of these kind of would launch around the same time. Well, except for Daikatana. And I don't think Half-Life had received much attention at that point. You know what I mean? It's like you see these big names attached to projects, and then there's just like this little company in Washington that's doing Half-Life, and everybody's like, all right, that looks fine. And it, you know, it kind of snuck up on us, I feel, which is, you know, satisfying.
It seemed like it stayed under the radar until they brought a good build of it to E3 in 97. They got a really good reaction from that. So, you know, once they started getting closer to release, they were trying to release it close to Quake 2. I don't know why you would want to do that, though. I never knew of like a strategy where like, yeah, I'm going to release this as soon as like, I don't know, the same day the new Call of Duty comes out. Like, you wouldn't want to have a direct competitor necessarily, but they seem to be very confident in what they're bringing to the table.
Yeah, I think they, you know, times were different on the PC back then. It was all about getting attention. Mm-hmm. And since I think Quake 2 was kind of very late in 97, you know, maybe they thought, hey, we can get out first, get some attention while there's really no other competition on the market. But, you know, probably wouldn't have worked out for them, especially knowing what happened to that version of the game.
So they ended up delaying the game because they had to rework the levels and the mechanics. And this is, again, at the end of the day, like, that's kind of like what Half-Life was really known for, was for, you know, the AI to a certain extent, the levels and just the mechanics of the gameplay. So they ended up assigning like a small team to build a prototype level containing every element of the game, and then spent a month iterating on the level. So it was just like continuing to try to like really produce the best possible version of the mechanics. I guess the second thing that the game was really known for, and this is really weird going back and playing it today, but it makes sense for 1997-98, they actually had a 30-page document of the game's narrative. They hired a writer, novelist Mark Laidlaw, yes, which, of course, Mark would go on to just, you know, pen some of the best stories in games. Again, fortunately, a lot of these folks have left Valve to help manage the script. He was hired to manage the script for the game to ensure in-game consistency. And again, you know, some of the most, you know, memorable parts about the game are some of the lines that are uttered by, you know, the scientists and the characters that you interact with. But it just shows that they really wanted to focus on having a consistent, you could maybe even call it cinematic-like story experience for the game, where, again, going back to some of the original statements, in some first-person shooters like Quake or Quake 2, your story is you're a guy on a planet, you have to kill a lot of stuff, and then kill the big thing at the end.
Well, that's the thing, you know, going back then, I was really into shooters, and most of them really didn't attempt to tell any narrative at all, or if they did, it was very, very shallow. Like, the idea was that you play the action. I mean, the few exceptions were more role-playing style games, like System Shock, mm-hmm. Ultima Underworld, the stuff that Warren Spector was doing. I mean, those had a strong story component, but it was much more driven by the text and, you know, logs and things like that. Whereas Half-Life was pretty much the first one that I had played where it was like direct characters, like essentially acting in front of you. Mm-hmm. Like, you're in the world, you're inhabiting the same space as the people, and you're essentially participating in the cutscenes to a limited degree. You know what I mean?
I think that was one of the things, well, I'm going to talk about it in the next segment, but I mean, that was one of the things like the PC Gamer magazines and stuff like that were really focusing on, like really trumpeting how big of a deal that this was. I think that's why they were such a fans of games like System Shock as well. And it's been really weird, just like a side note, because I've been doing like a lot of, I don't like to call it busy work, but work that doesn't need a ton of attention. And I've been listening to old, like One Up Yours podcast, just as like a time capsule to remember what it was like when these new consoles were coming out in 05 and 06, and having the whole idea of story-driven narratives, specifically in first-person shooters, come back up with games like BioShock and even Halo 3, where story was a little bit more of a core component to what the fans of the game kind of wanted if you were into those franchises. Just weird.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Halo 1 was even about that. I mean, after Half-Life, everybody wanted to be Half-Life. You know what I mean? Yeah. there was so many attempts after that to match it, and very few could really, you know, equal what Valve was doing in terms of just building that world and those characters that were engaging and interesting. I mean, you look back at it now and it seems a little bit quaint, I suppose, but at the time, I mean, it was truly a revolutionary thing, and it really drew you into the world like unlike anything else at the time.
So let's talk about the ports. Let's talk about first the one that actually made it to market, the PlayStation 2 port, which we'll reference quickly, was based off of the work that was being done on the Dreamcast port of the game that eventually got canceled. But it also included the Decay co-op mode. And this is really the only reason I ever saw this game is because my roommate bought it when we were in college. This would have been 2005 that he would have been playing this port of Half-Life 2 at this point.
Wow, like 4 years later.
like four years later, but also like blown away because my roommate had a PlayStation 2 and I had an Xbox. So like he was, there were not many great first-person shooter experiences on the PlayStation 2. So even a game that was originally out in 1998, but then ported to the PlayStation 2 with some up-resed graphics, with some new character models, new models for the gun, that actually was, I mean, it was like that or, and I was a big fan of it. It was like Red Faction. When are you going to play this? Some Red Faction, do some geomodding or something.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was interesting. Like, not only was it 16 by 9, but you mentioned in your video with a modded PlayStation 2, you could actually force it into progressive mode as well.
Oh, yeah. That's essentially any hacked PS2 can load. It's like the GS mode switcher. You can trigger the PS2 to output in a different mode. And because Half-Life runs internally in progressive scan, you know, it's doing the full frame buffer, you can just tell the system to output 480p or whatever you want, and it does actually work just fine.
So really, with a modded PS2, you could do that for, because I remember for some PlayStation 2 games, you had to like boot it up and hold down like a couple buttons to force it into like outputting at 480p, but there were some other games that would, like, you could do it, but you just had to kind of force it on, I guess, a, you know, a software or hardware level.
So yeah, I mean, essentially, the easiest way to look at it is that many games would have been capable of it, but it really depends on how the game is rendered internally. If you're doing a full frame buffer where you're rendering every line as a unique line, then you could force it. They could have coded it themselves, but if they didn't, you can use this sort of like homebrew software to do it. But for games that actually use the real interlacing mode, like, you know, Ridge Racer 5 did this. A lot of games use this because it let you hit 60 frames per second quite easily. But a true interlaced game would not work in progressive scan. So you would end up with a very weird kind of broken looking image. It just doesn't, it doesn't work at all. So it's kind of a weird quirk of the system that's possible to get around if you have a modded PS2. But again, because the resolutions of games can be weird, sometimes you end up with like strange screen shapes that require you to sort of stretch the image. You know what I mean? So it's not like a magic bullet, but it is kind of a cool thing, and it worked pretty well with Half-Life.
Yeah, I remember some games running a little bit odd on the like PlayStation 2, like the later day PS2 games. Like a lot of games were starting to support 480p because it was always weird. Because like the Xbox, the original Xbox, like did that a ton. Like there were a ton of games that would do.
Oh yeah.
So
Dreamcast too.
It, of course, yeah. I mean, Dreamcast too. That's where you got to have your VGA box, folks. So with, speaking of the Dreamcast, let's talk about the Dreamcast version, because this was, I mean, one of the main reasons why I wanted to do this episode is because, you know, especially when I was starting to get into like Dreamcast, downloading Dreamcast games back in probably like 05, 06. this is when like you, I mean, still on the internet, like we weren't always all talking about this stuff, but then you could still stumble upon cool things like, wait, there actually is a working version of Half-Life for the Dreamcast out there. And like, you could just download it, like it leaked out. So we mentioned it leaked out in 2003, but it was officially announced on Valentine's Day 2000 at a France, a game show in France. So this is where some of the initial work was getting done. So they doubled the poly count of the original models. This is where they originally were building the Blue Shift expansion, which would eventually mm-hmm. make its way out on PC. And then, you know, it's kind of an infamous story, but the review code of the game made it out to many publications, and some reviews actually were published. The literal game guide was published, but the game was canceled just weeks before release, with Sierra citing, quote, changing market conditions. So if you're thinking about this, we're talking about late 2001. Of course, the Dreamcast was officially going to end its life. So it didn't make a lot of sense, I guess, to put out this game that was still kind of rough. Like, you looked at a version of the game which was pretty much near final, John, and like, it was kind of running somewhat rough at 15 to 25 frames per second.
Yeah, and this is actually kind of something that applies to the Dreamcast as a whole. There was a push back then to bring PC games to the system, and there were a couple that were successful, like Quake 3 Arena, but Half-Life, along with games like Soldier of Fortune and a lot of other Quake engine-based titles, they just don't work well on the Dreamcast. The CPU isn't really capable of handling them. It doesn't have enough memory.
Yeah,
and loading assets from – yeah, it's the drive. Loading all that data from a GD-ROM, it was just – it was too much. So levels were split up into smaller chunks. Loading times were often very long. And, you know, this isn't just Half-Life either. It's a lot of these games were like this. And so, you know, I don't really feel that Half-Life for Dreamcast would have been a great release in the end. Like, it would have been a fascinating one. And I would have been happy to see it exist. But I think, like most of those PC to Dreamcast ports, it probably just would have been a disappointment in the end.
I even tried when I was, getting into the what are those things called? News groups. So groups back in the day that would just also happen to be home of complete images for games. so that's how I got my copy of Half-Life for the Dreamcast. So this is probably like 2007 or something. It was probably 2006 when I was kind of playing through it. And I'm like, no, this is awesome. I'm going to play all the way through Half-Life on the Dreamcast. I'm a huge Dreamcast fan. But the problem that you would also run into is that at some point, if you didn't have one of those weird third-party memory cards, you'd actually have a save file that was so large you couldn't even save it.
I forgot about that. You're absolutely right. The more you save, the larger the save file gets until it outgrows your VMU.
It's
awful.
It was because it wasn't, it wasn't final build.
Yeah, it wasn't final, exactly.
You know, eventually that's probably something they could have fixed, but it was a bug that kind of sort of makes the game almost unplayable. Like, I was even impressed how far you got through in the video of playing through the game. I'm like, even without the save file issue, like, the game was still kind of really difficult to play, like many other first-person shooters on the Dreamcast without a keyboard and mouse.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know Half-Life pretty well, so I was able to get through it. But between the save file stuff and the controls, it's not that pleasant of an experience. It's really just a piece of history to look at and kind of imagine what would have been.
But this is one of those things of like retro video games. And even back then, as someone that did not have a great PC, I was able to play Half-Life on the PC, but it was always a fascination when you would have these ports come to like the Nintendo 64, or you'd have these ports come to even the original PlayStation. Or that was one of the big drivers of why I wanted a Sega Saturn, is because there are going to be all these great first person shooters that I couldn't get on the PC, but
so home console. You weren't into the PC at that point, right?
Well, it was always my parents' computer.
Right, I see. So you're kind of limited, yeah.
Yeah, it was always limited, and also in terms of trade-in, that's kind of how I lived my life as a kid.
Oh,
and I would trade
in
games to get the next game, so I would not be able to trade in. Like, it wasn't very common. You couldn't go to like an EB Games, to my recollection, because you'd have like CD keys and all this stuff, but you couldn't really trade in PC games, but you could always trade in a console game, so the value was always tough. A lot of the PC games that I played back then were at the counter of your Babbage's or your software, et cetera, or whatever it might be. There would be kind of like a tray at the front, like a display where you could get these shareware copies of games for 99 cents. So I played through the first episode of lots of games like Shadow Warrior, Duke Nukem 3D, Quake, because you could just buy these CDs for 99 cents that would have a third of the game on it. So like that's how I played most of my games. I played the first third and then I never went back to them unless it was like years and years later.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, I was really into the PC at that time. And for anybody that was there, that was like still the beginning of the 3D accelerator boom.
Yeah.
I mean, now you need a graphics card. But back then, it was still kind of an optional thing. And games were really trying to push that forward. And Quake 2 was one of the first games that was like, look, you really need a 3D card.
Color lighting, folks.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Half-Life comes out and I did, you know, I think I still had my Power VR card. So it was a Power VR PCX2, which it's not the same Power VR in the Dreamcast. It's like a generation before the Dreamcast chipset, but it wasn't that fast with Half-Life. And I was playing it on an AMD K6 233 megahertz PC. And even, you know, it was a reasonable PC for the time, but the frame rate in Half-Life, like especially when all the particles would kick in and, you know, the silo with the large tentacle creature, mm-hmm. you get to that thing and it's like 10 frames a second. It's well, pretty rough.
Let's do this. Let's get back in the time machine. Let's go back in time.
Right.
We'll talk about our PC builds and how we played this back in the day. And you folks can do that as well. Let's take a quick break and listen to some more music from Half-Life. Or it could just be like any year, because for PC games specifically, like, you know, lots of them were, you could just stumble upon them years and years later, which is kind of like what I did with Half-Life, because I didn't have a really good PC to play this stuff on, or sometimes those games were too expensive. So, John, you're talking a little bit about it briefly in the previous segment, but what were you running? Were you said you were picking up Half-Life on release day. Was your,
oh, yeah.
was your PC ready for it?
I was there on day one, and I was there in 1998, and my PC was moderately ready for it.
So you said you had, I remember there's like AMD, those K6 chips or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. So that, you know, a Pentium MMX 200 or something would have been awesome, but I had a 233 K6, which was a pretty good system, but for Quake Engine games, it was kind of a little bit weak when using a 3D graphics card. So a fun fact is that I actually learned how to mouse look because of that PC. I played Quake 2 with the Power VR card, and the performance just wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. But I found that if I looked towards the floor a little bit the frame rate was higher. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to use the mouse and kind of look down until I encounter an enemy. And it was like smoother to play. So that was the game that really got me into the mouse look. Because before that, it was kind of an optional thing. I mean, Quake 1 was a big deal for it, but, you know, not everybody was using it. So that was the game that pushed me there.
That was probably the time we got to 98, yeah.
you know. Yeah, exactly. I think that's the same for a lot of people. That was the game that did it. So I do want to bring a little context to 1998 here when we're talking. So the PC space, there were some big games in that fall. Like one of them, Sin. You don't hear a lot of talk about this anymore, but you know, this had some pretty serious PC pedigree behind it. Obviously, the most well-known being the Level Lord working on it, who did a lot of work on Duke 3D. And Sin, I've always felt, is kind of like a sequel to Duke Nukem 3D in a way, like mm-hmm. in a weird way. It's kind of like a follow-up to that, and I like the game, but it launched in a horrible state. the initial version was so broken. I mean, your save files would balloon to be like 600 megabytes, which at the time, you know, that's insane. That's bigger than the game itself.
So did you actually have the ability to download updates via the internet for this?
Yes, I did over a modem, and it was slow. And they did patch in and fix it, but it launched in a bad state and really hurt the game. And then there was also stuff like Raven put out Heretic 2 that year. Mm-hmm. Both that and Sin had like specially named days. Like I think Heretic 2 had like a specific day for it, and Sin, it was like Sin Day, Bloody Sin Day. I mean, it was like weird stuff like that, like all the marketing blitz around it. That was also the year that Thief came out, which was a game along with Half-Life that really shaped my love of the PC at the time. But so, you know, I picked up Half-Life, put it on my K6, and it was quite playable, but not completely smooth. I did eventually get a 3DFX card the next year. So on the Voodoo, it did play a lot better. But, you know, you hear a lot of talk about PC games today. Everybody's like, oh, I'm just going to go for 60 frames or 120 frames per second, no problem. But back then, like even getting to 30 frames per second on a cutting edge game mm-hmm. was pretty difficult. You really needed some high end gear to even get close. And, you know, with Half-Life, it wasn't that demanding of a game, but you still needed a pretty powerful machine to run it quite well.
Well, I remember like back then, how old are you, John? Are you're like in your 30s?
I'm 35.
Okay, yeah. So like if you're like me, back then we just kind of, I mean, I think this is why people have such rose-colored, you know, rose-tinted glasses when we look back at like stuff on the Nintendo 64 is because, you know, we just didn't care that games ran at like 20 frames per second. Like we were just happy, especially if you're booting things up on a PC. Sometimes it was just a celebration to get games to
boot
on a PC.
Exactly.
Let alone to make sure that we're getting like 30 or even, you know, more impossible, 60 frames per second on these games. So I'm sure, you know, a lot of the games that I played back then were probably like a solid 15 to 20 frames per second, but you didn't care. You were just pumped that you were playing the game.
I mostly didn't care, except for when you would go to like one of those PC like sort of conventions where they would sell a lot of PC hardware.
Right.
You'd roll in there and they got like the fastest Pentium 2 with like some SLI Voodoo 2 cards in there running like Unreal or Half-Life at like a super smooth frame rate, and I'm just like drooling on it. And then you look at the price tag and you're like, okay, well, I'm not getting that.
$1,000 or something like that for
exactly.
a desktop PC in 98 or 99.
Yep.
This is kind of why I think I was really lucky that I ended up picking the game up so many years later. Like I picked it up in 2000. So by that time, and we'll probably end up going back and forth on this stuff, 2000, I was 14. So it's like as soon as I turned 14, I was down at we had to go to our high school in Massachusetts to get a work permit. You had to go to the superintendent to make sure you had good grades and all this stuff. So I ended up getting my first job, and one of the first things that I bought was a compact Presario, which was a Black Friday deal at I don't know if folks remember, but CompUSA.
I do.
Yeah, CompUSA actually used to have some really great deals. You get, I remember like even a couple months later, once I could afford a, I think it was a 4X CD burner from a no-name brand. That was also where you would go to get your CD spindles of no-name, you know, CDRs because they would basically be free. You could, the CompUSA was the king of mail-in rebates where you could basically get like floppy disks and CDRs for free. So I went to CompUSA a lot. But this was a deal because back then my dad was my credit card. So he would like, we would go in, we would have some sort of plan. Like, this is the payment plan. Like, I can pay you $25 a month for the next like year to pay this off. I'll pay for half it now. And like, it was great because he was like, I don't care. Like, as long as you pay me back, it's not a big deal. So, I went in, I got that awesome compact Presario desktop. And I don't know if you remember these Presarios, but it was clearly they were trying to like compete in terms of a visual aesthetic to the IMAX back then.
Oh yeah.
Remember? Because they had like the color, different colored, like face plates on the front of them.
Yep. It was like big bulbous plastic with lots of colors.
Exactly. And you could like pull it down and you'd like get access to like USB ports or something like that. Okay. Yeah. I'm actually pulling up a picture of it right now. Or like, no, you'd hide, like you'd put CDs in that thing in the front. Like you'd put like the software.
Oh yeah. That's right.
Or like the driver CDs and stuff. So it was like the cheapest. It might have been like $400. It was a desktop only because I had a monitor that my brother stole from work, and which I don't think there's a statute of limitations for that. So I'll say that brought home from work because it was also at the. And it's so funny, the person he worked for that he brought it home from now trains at my gym, so I think I'm okay with that.
Oh, nice.
it's a weird world. It was the dot-com era where there was just stacks and stacks of monitors and PCs. So you could just take a PC home and no one would really realize it. But it came with Windows ME installed, the best version of Windows. And ooh. Yeah, I know. But hey, it was better than Windows NT, which I was running before in a different computer, which was not friendly with games at all.
Yeah, that's not meant for games.
No, it was such a weird computer too, also that was brought home from work that my brother was working at. But it was really weird because for some reason this computer that I had with Windows NT in it, like anyone cares, there was no way we could get Windows 98 to install and run properly on it. It would only work with Windows NT. It was such a weird thing. That same CompUSA a couple weeks later after I bought the Presario, this is how I bought Half-Life. It was in the Half-Life Platinum Collection. So this was... Ooh. Obviously years later, right? So it was came with Half-Life, it came with Blue Shift, it came with Opposing Force, it came with Team Fortress and Counter-Strike. It was 5 discs in one box and it was $20.
That is a steal right there.
It was awesome because I mean I remembered Half-Life from seeing it in the multitude of PC gamer magazines that I constantly they had maybe 24 aliases of mine. For PC gamers, so I could continually get two free issues every 2 months. But like I knew about Half-Life, but getting this package, I didn't know anything about Team Fortress or Counter-Strike or Blue Shift or any of that stuff. So when I got home, I got to install all of this stuff. And like, this is kind of one of the things I want to talk about. I mean, Half-Life is great. And I played through it. It was fantastic. It was a difficult game. It was a fun game. But I also, in this episode, just so we don't have to devote separate episodes, I want to also talk about Team Fortress and Counter-Strike. Because to me, specifically Team Fortress, I played more Team Fortress than probably any game like within a 3-year span when I got that. Because that was... It was just like the most incredible online gaming. It was probably the first online gaming experience I had outside of SegaNet.
You know, you're probably not alone on that either.
Like it was awesome because you had people with also microphones. You had,
oh yeah.
Like you could do things like I was always the engineer because I loved the idea of just building turrets that would mow folks down. Like it was just such a fun game and all like the weird like level mods. You just always boot up like a new stage, like a new custom stage or something like that. I don't know if you, so, did you play a lot of TF?
Yeah. So I actually started with Team Fortress in its Quake iteration because, you know, Quake mods were kind of the thing, right? Like, you know, Quake Rally was crazy, you know, all that stuff. Loading up Quake mods was cool. And I did play a lot of Team Fortress with a friend of mine and we had a great time with it. So, of course, when it was released for Half-Life, the Gold Source engine, you know, it was a nice upgrade over what you got in Quake 1. And sure, we played that too.
I mean, I think, I don't know what it was about. Oh God, it's just Team Fortress was just such a badass game. And I wish I got into TF2 as much as I did the first game. But, I mean, to my defense, it was probably because I played TF2 through the orange box on the Xbox 360, which, if you remember, had...
Not the best version.
No, it never actually ran well, and then they never updated it. It was a really big, you know, fun thing that they got
to
do.
So that's an interesting thing to discuss then is, you know, in 99 or so or 2000, I was actually hyped for Team Fortress 2, because that had been announced as a thing, and it was a realistic looking version.
Remember?
Yeah, there were screenshots that looked like whoa, look at those character models. Like, this looks insane, and everybody was super psyched for Team Fortress 2, and then it just never materialized until much, much, much later, and it was basically a different thing altogether.
That's right, because it looked a lot like the original Team Fortress. Just like a better looking version of it.
Exactly. It was like a massively visually enhanced version of Team Fortress.
I mean, obviously, I never ended up getting into Blue Shift or Opposing Force at all. I was kind of like, I played like an hour or two of each of them, but they just didn't. I mean, Gearbox did, you know, decent stuff back in the day, but they just never, like, they just felt like mods.
Yeah, I did play through Opposing Force on the PC, and I did like that. Never really, I mean, I never finished Blue Shift. I played with it a little bit, but yeah, it never really hooked me in the same way. Maybe just too little, too late kind of thing.
But I'm trying to think of, there's a bunch of stuff I want to talk about, but I want to take too long in this stuff. So anyways, I mean, outside of, I just it's so weird. Like, I just want to be like, Chris Farley, man, like that game was awesome. Like, that game was so awesome. And just like those five games was probably the next 6 months of my life. That's like all I played were, you know, Half-Life, but mostly TF, and then a little bit of Counter-Strike. Did you ever get into Counter-Strike at all?
Now, Counter-Strike is one I didn't really get into in any significant way. I did play a little bit of it back in the day, but you know, it's a very demanding game. You really have to know what you're doing, and I just never put the time in to learn. And thus, when I do play, I tended to get steamrolled. So yeah, never really played a lot of Counter-Strike.
Well, you got to find the right servers. And that was the other thing. Oh God, this is like all
fun. Oh, yeah.
I didn't even think about this, but like, you would always have like the servers you would always play on. Like, you would, that it would always be packed and that you would have to kind of wait for a spot on. But like, that's like how I started getting my first community. Like, again, I was 14, but like, I started like remembering folks that I was like playing with, and they would remember you when you would, what the hell was my username? It was like Captain Larrabee. It was something stupid like that. I think it was, or no, maybe, I forget what it was. I'm sorry, the folks don't care about this. But it's just, I'm having a weird nostalgia flashback, which is the reason for this show. Did you ever, I mean, talking about like games that came up as follow-ups, did you ever like have a lot of hype for Sin Episodes?
Oh man, the Episodes. Not, I mean, I was interested in it, but it's, I don't really love Sin Episodes. It's not, it's all right, but it's really different from the previous one. But what I did like was the expansion pack for Sin called Wages of Sin. Did you play that?
I didn't play. The only time I've ever heard of Sin, the only time I ever hear people talk about Sin is when Half-Life is brought up, and I think it's only Jeff Gerstmann who brings up how Sin is better than Half-Life for some reason.
Okay, so I guess what's interesting to me about Sin Episodes is that it was developed by a third-party company called 2015 Games. Those guys, that I think Sin Episodes or Sin Wages of Sin was the first product they released. So they released an add-on pack for another studio's game, which was done with Quake and Quake 2 as well. But 2015 would go on to make Medal of Honor Allied Assault.
Oh,
and then they would split off and join with Activision, where they would make Call of Duty. So it's this weird like thing where it's like, all right, Call of Duty kind of traces all the way back to Sin.
Okay, that's one reason to like Sin, I guess. Sorry. And then there was a port of Sin on the N64 too, right?
No. There was a port of Daikatana though.
Oh, course,
and I think I actually have a boxed version of the Japanese version of Daikatana for Nintendo 64 here.
I hope you didn't pay more than like 500 yen for that.
I did not.
Thank God.
It was very cheap, but it was hilarious to me at the time. I was like, this is, I don't even know why I have this, but this is great.
Well, I mean, that was like a Blockbuster exclusive release in the States.
Yeah, it was a rental thing in the States, but it received a full package in Japan for some reason. And it's like, I mean, okay.
Well, I appreciate that they didn't have to force us to buy that game. They allowed us to rent it here in the States and realize that it was not only a probably a bad game, but also that it ran like many Nintendo 64 first-person shooters, at about 15 frames per second.
Yeah, so I actually have a soft spot for actual Daikatana. That's a whole another episode. It's not as bad of a game as people seem to think, but Daikatana 64 is a very bad game, and it is not at all related to the PC game outside of some basic themes. It's like a Kemco joint or something.
Ugh, okay. I mean, I bring this up a lot, but if we ever do a first-person shooter on the Nintendo 64, it will be either Doom or Duke Nukem 64. Duke Nukem 64 is dope.
They're both great.
All right, so it was weird. We haven't really talked much about the game itself. It was mostly like everything surrounding the game. That's partially my fault. But I mean, back then, did you see the original Half-Life as just like a huge leap forward in storytelling? Is that something you appreciated about it, or was it just like the action?
It was both. So obviously, you know, the stuff like the introduction where it's a slow intro on the tram, that was really revolutionary. And then there was a lot of stuff like the game used CD music for the soundtrack, but it was all dynamic, so it would trigger during certain events.
Right.
So that, you know, that was kind of a cool thing as well. But I think what really pushed me over the top was the interactions with the AI. Like the AI itself was rather advanced for the time. Mm-hmm. And you would see enemy troops and the aliens like perform maneuvers and run around and act away, and they would communicate with voice in such a way that it really seemed like you were dealing with a more intelligent foe rather than just, like most shooters at the time, an enemy that would just run at you firing their weapon until they're dead. You know what I mean?
Yeah, true. Like, I mean, we'll get back to this more in the second segment. Maybe it was just different back then where, again, like in games like Doom or Duke Nukem, you just have the enemies kind of like run towards you and firing, and you would just dump there into them. But I guess they would take some cover when you were going against like the military forces in Half-Life. And you'd like, some of it was just like, oh, this is the thing that if I had one thing that I hated about Half-Life, and I probably still hate about it today, are those ninjas. The ninjas that just like, they're just hard to kill. They're not really like, it's not good AI. It's just, they're a pain in the ass.
Yeah, you're right. But I think, you know, part of the strength of the game, and the ninjas apply to that as well, is that there was this sense of surprise and variety where, you know, you could go through one area and then the next section would be very different. You know, when you get to the silo with the huge tentacle, or the system where you're going on the train cars, or I guess it's on a rail.
And you fight against the Duke Nukem boss.
Exactly.
3D dude.
Or, you know, even little things like the point where you're crawling through the air ducts and they start like firing bullets up into the ducts and they like sort of simulate like the light piercing through the bullet holes. I mean, there was never anything like that at the time. And just so it was the first game that really leaned into scripting in that way. And they didn't overdo it to the point that you would see with some later Call of Duty games where it's just super scripted. But there was a lot of sequences that would play out in front of you that just felt really cool, and it put you in a unique situation beyond your control, and that was really, really fun to play through and experience back in the day.
Like there would be two soldiers or something that would be, while you were in the vents, they would be talking to each other like, yeah man, like these, we're getting no resistance from these scientists, we're just mowing them down, it's no fun. Like,
yeah, and that's kind of the whole thing.
You pop out of the vent and then you mow them down.
And it's like when they first, you know, introduce enemies, it's all done in a more nuanced fashion. Like when the soldiers first show up, you come out of a room and a scientist is running towards the door like, oh, they're here to save us. And the soldiers just gun them down. And you're immediately like, that's not good. It just sets up this dramatic moment like that.
Yeah. Now that we're talking about this, it reminds me that I also like this. Maybe horror is not the right word, but there was so much more tension for me playing this than playing something like Doom 2 or Duke Nukem 3D, because it seems like you really don't understand what is going on. Because you would think, like, when you get to the surface for the first time, you think like, oh, okay, I did it. I got to the surface. Like, that was what I was supposed to do. I get to the surface. And even before that, you're having some, interaction with the soldiers, and you're going in through some combat there, but maybe those are just like bad guys, maybe there was a misunderstanding. But once you get to the surface, and then there's like helicopters like dropping bombs on you and stuff like that, and just everything completely hits the fan, it's just a like severe shift in tone and unlike anything I had played before that.
Yep, exactly. And that's, you know, that's what stuck out for people that played it, I think.
All right. That makes sense. I mean, I know like it's just tough because now we're talking about this game being 20 years old this year. It's just such a, we're getting old, such a long time ago. Well, let's do this. So let's take another break. We'll probably continue this discussion. Let's talk about how the game holds up in 2018, our thoughts on it today, and maybe a little bit about the time between that and Half-Life 2. So stick around. We'll be right back. So let's talk about Half-Life today. In 2018, almost 20 years after its initial release, and the cool thing about Half-Life, and I guess Valve to a certain extent, is that you can play this game on anything that pretty much has a processor in it. As long as it's a desktop or a laptop, the game runs really well. Like, I have a 2017 15-inch MacBook Pro, like with a Retina screen, or you can even hook it up to a monitor and go 4K. Like, you could scale it up to 4K. The only issue is maybe a text thing, and like, why would you want to scale it up to 4K? But it's cool because pretty much everyone who has a Steam account owns this game because it's been like $1, a lot.
Yeah. I mean, that's just when Valve first opened Steam, that was like the only thing you could even have on there. So I think a lot of people, you know, it was just like, all right, well, I'll just get Half-Life.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, there's a couple ways to play it. You can obviously play it on, I mean, if you want to pull out a PS2, you could play it on the PS2. You could, you know, try to, you know, go through the Dreamcast version if you hate yourself. But you could not only play the original PC release, which was later ported to, obviously it was on the PC, but then it was ported to Linux and Mac OS in 2013 or 2014. And, that way you could kind of play it on any computer out there. But then there were also, this was when Half-Life 2 was released, they had Half-Life Source, which was a remade version of Half-Life based off of the Half-Life 2 engine. Did you ever play that version at all?
Yes. So that's based on the Source engine. And I think the original idea was simply like, to showcase how easy it is to work with Source, mm-hmm. and they were able to bring over the original game into the new engine fairly effortlessly. And if I recall, it was originally included with the collector's edition of Half-Life 2, which I bought back in the day. You put your Steam key in,
and it just,
which again, that was a very new thing at the time, by the way, Steam keys. Half-Life 2 was like the first big release to use Steam, and you would end up with Half-Life Source as well.
One day we will talk about Half-Life 2 in my story of walking to Walmart to buy the boxed version on 5 DVDs, bringing it back to my dorm room, and then not being able to play the game, even though it's installed in my computer because they could not unlock the content from Steam. Remember on release of Half-Life 2 how it just like completely hit the fan and no one could play Half-Life 2?
There was a lot of issues.
I would write, I mean, unless you wanted to play that awesome. I mean, Half-Life 2 is a game that we're absolutely going to do in the future, not only because it's a great game, but it's also just a weird, it's a weird story in terms of like all the code leaking out. I mean, there was literally a kind of like playable version of like the first part of the game that was up on, you know, Wear sites and BitTorrent and stuff like that. And also, not 6 feet from me is the original Xbox version of Half-Life 2, which is really impressive itself. And then it came to the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 on the orange box. So Half-Life 2 is a hell of a game that we'll talk about at some point. But What's your preferred version to play today? Because there's also not only the source version, but there's Black Mesa as well, which has its own really weird backstory.
Yeah, so I guess there's two ways I would play it. You know, it is kind of fun for me to load it up on like an older style PC with the original release just to experience how it was back in the day.
Do you have like a you do have like a Pentium 2 PC in your house, right?
I have a Pentium 4, but I'm trying to get some older PC hardware in here even to get a more authentic experience. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that goes. I have some projects in the work for that. But another thing, though, is, yeah, you mentioned Black Mesa Source, and I actually really do like it. It's never been finished, and I haven't kept up with it, so I'm not sure what the state of it is. But I believe they basically built the game up until you go to Zen. And then they were kind of replanning Zen and trying to figure out what to do with it from there. And that's so okay.
They finished it.
Yeah, they basically finished it as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But from what I understand, what they wanted to do with Zen was sort of redevelop it into something different and better. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I haven't seen it yet, so I'm not sure how that's going to turn out. But I think it's a cool re-envisioning.
That's the thing is, as I played through it again for the show, went all the way up to Zen. I never want to play that part ever again, because I mean, it's kind of like cliche, but it, like everyone says it, it's totally true. It just destroys the end of the game. It's a really bad ending. It's not good at all.
Yeah. I mean,
like the platforming and stuff, like when we talk about revisiting this game today, one of the things that I realized is that there's actually kind of a lot of platforming that you need to do in the original Half-Life. And it's not very, like, it's not a well-controlling game in terms of having to jump from platform to platform or from vent to vent. Like, it's not great.
You should try doing that puzzle with the boxes dangling on the Dreamcast version. Platforming God. On that. Every time you die, it's like, well, another 60 seconds of loading.
And I haven't played Half-Life in probably since 04 or 05, or like screwing around with it on the Dreamcast, which I didn't get that far in. And I could not believe how much platforming is in this. Like, even when you're going through the facility either, like there's just like boxes that you need to jump on and like stuff that you need to, like you're constantly having to hold down control, which, by the way, yeah, new MacBooks suck. They're terrible. The keyboards are terrible. I know it's not a good excuse, but having to like jump and then also hit control to duck while you're playing this game is just like kind of a pain in the butt. That was like really one of their things, is trying to produce like platforming sections, not like gigantic platforming sections, but I always hated the fact that they would have things that were just high enough or just that much of a pain in the ass to get into that you would have to do the jump control, even though it's not like
maneuver. Again, it's fine on a normal keyboard, but you're right. If you play it with the wrong controller or keyboard, it feels a little bit not great. But I think you mentioned platforming. I think that's kind of a key part of its variety, though, is that the game really tries to throw so many things at you. I mean, there's platforming, there's puzzle solving, you know, like things when you go into the one room, there's the electricity running through it. You can't walk in the water. You have to get through that. You know, they kind of mix up stuff like that to keep the pace interesting and just keep the game rolling in an interesting way.
Well, I found it fascinating for myself when I was playing through it again that I was actually getting, I don't want to call it bored, I don't want to say that it was necessarily tedious, but like I remembered sections, like I never really liked the train car section and stuff like that, because I'm not necessarily a gigantic puzzle, you know, fan.
Oh,
like,
sure.
I just want to like continue to move forward. And when you're backtracking and like, oh, is this going the right way? It's not actually really difficult, but it's more of a case of, okay, I know what's coming up. I just want to move forward. I want to, you know, destroy this boss and just progress in the game. And that's, I think that's where they did a much better job in Half-Life 2. Like Half-Life 2 is just a huge leap forward in the puzzle design. And obviously the benefits of just having a really great physics engine in the game versus like the boxes sliding on the floor in the original Half-Life, like it's made of like, it's like two slabs of ice.
Oh yeah. I mean, exactly. Physics were at the time were pretty much limited to Jurassic Park Trespasser and no other game.
Right. But I mean, it's still, I didn't think I was going to have this much of like a nostalgia like flood when I played this game, but we talked about Team Fortress 2, and it's still like sometimes it make me feel uneasy whenever I'd hear the intercom, like the announcer in the facility, because it was also the same announcer that they used in Team Fortress. But it was just so uneasy feeling, because it's not like it's digitized voice, but it is such a low pitch. Like, it is just very uneasy. I don't know why that stood out to me so much.
Yeah, no, I mean, certain sound effects just stick with you. For me, it's like, you know, the Halo announcer, or I guess I was surprised when, you know, the thing with Rare was the Killer Instinct voice of Chris Sutherland. Because mm-hmm. when you actually meet him and talk to him, he's just like, you know, he's a thin programmer dude. And then you hear him do the Killer Instinct voice, and you're just like, whoa. So yeah, those kinds of like certain sounds and voice clips in games really stick out. And it's the same for Half-Life, Counter-Strike, Team Fortress as well. Like, for Half-Life, for me, it's when you hear the Marines are talking on
their
little intercoms, that walkie-talkie sound, God, that dude. They have. It's just like, oh, no.
Yeah, because like they and this is another thing from playing through it again, you know, specifically talking about the soldiers, like you would just dump assault rifle, you know, shots into their head. Like they could take like 10 shots to the head before they would go down. Like the balance was not, it wasn't necessarily realistic when it came to the combat. And again, like going back to those ninjas, like, you know what those ninjas are good for? Like, or what the grenades are good for? They're for ninjas, because that's like the easiest, quickest way to get rid of them. Or the, you know, the grenades that were part of the gun too. Like that was kind of the best ways to get rid of those guys.
Oh yeah.
Lots of scientists die in this game. Like constantly scientists are being mowed down by turrets, by enemies, by soldiers, sacrificed quite a bit.
So that's an interesting thing, right? So I'm living in Germany now, and a friend of mine, played Half-Life back in the day. And as I've learned since then, is when this game was released in Germany, they replaced a lot of the enemies and scientists with robots.
That makes sense.
A lot like Probotector. So it's so the game was completely edited here for the longest time. And it's like everything is a big chunky robot. It's really weird, that version.
I mean, I didn't make it back to Zen, but I thought it was, I don't think the boss battles hold up very well.
Oh yeah.
I don't think, I mean, what do you think? The biggest things that stand out to me in terms of what really stands the test of time in this game is just like the opening, like the opening where you're, like you said, you're on the tram, you're talking to a bunch of NPCs, you're getting to know the area, you're going to get your HEV suit, and then up to the point where they're basically, and it's like, it's weird, like even the scientists are talking about it, it's like, yeah, like Gordon's just kind of like an intern, he's just like a low-level dude, if he dies in this experiment, like no real loss. And then after that, it becomes somewhat, and it, not like it's a bad thing, but it becomes like a dated first-person shooter with some interesting puzzle mechanics in it.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It is that introduction that really stands out. Like, it's not super engaging gameplay-wise, but today. But at the time, just like being let loose in a laboratory like that before all hell broke loose was really kind of awesome.
Yeah, and I think it's now when we talk about first-person shooters, when we talk about games, it is generally highlighted when a game gives you some downtimes, when there's kind of like ebbs and flows of the gameplay. And if a game can really hit it out of the park when it comes to like having some more somber moments, or having some moments where you're able to explore before going back to the action. So it's just not, you know, constantly throwing more guys at you to take down, more people trying to kill you.
Exactly.
Any other big things that kind of stand out to you? I wonder, can you actually play Team Fortress Classic still? Do people still play that?
I haven't tried that for a while, so I'm not entirely sure. But it would not surprise me one bit if people were still playing it.
You know what sucks is you can buy it right now, and it costs $5. Somehow I don't own this on my Steam account.
I guess it's probably still played then.
Oh, my God. Like, just looking at these pictures of the heavy weapon dude and the engineers and the medics like this and the snipers. Oh, man, those sniper shots. I have such weird feelings about these games. I think I'm going to totally buy Team Fortress Classic. I just hope it's not full of people that are cheating.
Yeah, you know, and it's something about those games is that that had just like just the right amount of complexity at the time, I think, where it was interesting, but it wasn't like so full with like unlocks and RPG mechanics and meters to charge and all that stuff. It was just, you know, you get in there, you have fun, and that's it.
Well, look, I'm like looking at this, and again, just I apologize for saying, but even did you ever play Day of Defeat?
Oh, that one I did not play.
Okay, yeah, I played a lot of Day of Defeat too.
I've heard it was quite popular though, so
it was, but then when, as soon as you played Call of Duty, you're like, no, Day of Defeat is Day of Defeat was really janky. like some other of the mods for Half-Life, man, what a hell of a game. What a hell of a game. All right. Well, that is, going to be where we end it for folks on there. For the patrons, we are going to continue on. We're going to have a discussion about the PlayStation 3, talking about collecting for that. I'm starting to get into that a little bit. Best practices and things that you should keep an eye out for before they get too expensive. So if you want to get access to that, go to patreon.com/backinmyplay. You support the show on a per episode basis. So only pay and support the show when a new episode gets produced. So it means a lot if you go over there. You got about 66 listeners doing that. To get a lot more would be fantastic, so we can set aside more time to produce more episodes and more Patreon-exclusive content. Before we wrap up, John, what do you have coming up? Again, you're always kind of like in Adobe Premiere, putting together more and more videos. Anything that the audience should keep an eye out for in terms of what you're doing for Digital Foundry and Digital Foundry Retro?
Yeah, so on the DF Retro side, I have sort of a retrospective on Panzer Dragoon 1 and 2 coming up this weekend, which should be pretty fun. Oof. I was just finishing that up right now.
Those games hold up, man.
Yeah, they're fun, especially the second one. I was kind of surprised to go back and be like, okay, this is still awesome. I love this.
This is my ignorance, but that's why, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Which is just German for two.
Oh, yeah. It's fine. All right. Yeah. No, that's not even German. That's Switzerland. I watched Cool Runnings the other night, folks. Heads up.
But hey, you know, on the Panzer Dragoon Zwei disc, the Japanese disc, it says Panzer Dragoon Zwei is one of the best 3D shooting games available, presented for your pleasure.
That's very nice. They
couldn't be more right.
They were very right. God, like, you're still like, you started a, what'd you call it? Like a new season a couple months ago, and you've been cranking those episodes out pretty regularly now.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of work to keep those going, but I have some really cool projects hopefully in the works this year that will involve more interviews and more documentary style videos. So I'm excited about that. I am also planning some odd things. I'm going to do an episode on Turok Dinosaur Hunter, which I have a soft spot for.
Totally.
You know, it's good stuff. I'm also still have an Atari Jaguar episode coming up at some point. But that's
working Jaguar CD?
I don't have the CD, unfortunately. That's been a real difficult one to get. But I do have a huge number of games available to test here. So I've been kind of going through that. I want to do one. And then another one that's kind of in the works is an Xbox special with so, you know, you did Summer of Xbox recently.
That's right.
I'm going to go back into the Xbox, and I'm working with a fellow on this as well, who has access to tons of old gear and like prototype stuff.
Awesome.
Early dev kits, prototype controllers, unreleased games. And we're just going to kind of go through all kinds of stuff with that. And then I'm also going to look at stuff like how Xbox One X handles regular Xbox One games or regular Xbox games as well. You know, just the whole thing. So there will be an Xbox special coming up sometime in the next couple months.
I'm looking at a box of Xbox games right now. It's actually, the next episode is an Xbox game. Spoiler, we're doing Burnout 3
Good choice.
Since all the Burnout Paradise stuff is coming out, and I have friends that say Burnout Paradise is terrible, which I think they are terrible people for thinking that.
That's so wrong. But
if they want to talk about Burnout 3, I will play through Burnout 3. So I have that on the queue. I will take an excuse. And I'm actually testing out, I mean, you probably know a lot about these, but I bought like 3 component to HDMI adapters to get the Xbox up on my good TV. So hopefully that works.
Cool.
I'm hoping. And you also had a video recently talking about the Analog Super NT, which folks seem to be really happy with.
Yeah, that's an awesome piece of hardware. Yeah, it's great. I was really impressed with it.
So yeah, you guys can go and buy one of those, $200, and then you can spend like $300 for every Super Nintendo game you want to play on it. All right, well, that is going to do it for us. You can also check out John on Twitter so you can stay up to date, Dark1X on Twitter. And until next time, thank you to everyone for tuning in. Again, Patreon, stick around because we're going to have an extra segment for you in just a moment. Hey, thank you, Patreons. You're supporting the show, and you're getting an extra segment in. This is always kind of where I like to workshop some ideas that I have going around in my head. I don't know what necessarily triggered it. I want to say that it is because I finished Yakuza Kiwami, and then I wanted to play more Yakuza games, and we have 2 that will be Kiwami 2, which is out in Japan. It will probably come out here next year. But there are, of course, 3, 4, and 5 on the PlayStation 3, and I already own them. I bought them all, but I don't have a PlayStation 3 anymore, so I think that's why I started looking for PlayStation 3s. But John, it isn't like the 360 and the Wii, where those have like gone down to like $60, $70 at the local used stores around here. Like, to get a good PlayStation 3 in not terrible condition, you're looking at $130 to $150.
Yeah, they never really came down in price. That's kind of a strange thing like that. But and especially if you wanted to get like one of the original fat models with the full backwards compatibility, it's like not even worth it because it's unreliable.
Exactly. It's like you're going to use that for 2 days and then the yellow light will start blinking.
Yeah, exactly.
On you. But I think like this is where it all comes down to. When you get to the end of the life of the console, it's always like, all right, well, what's the best revision of the console to get? So with the PlayStation 3, we always have the original fat, which had a couple of iterations with the, you know, we had the 60, which has like the full backwards compatibility. Then we had like the 80, which had
partial
software backwards compatibility. And then we had the Slim, which had no backwards compatibility. And then there was also other PS3s. There was the 40 with no backwards compatibility, which is how they got the $399 originally. But we got the Fat, we got the Slim, we got the Super Slim with like the slidey tray thing, which is a really ugly design, but probably the most reliable one.
Well, here's the thing about the Super Slim. In black, it does look ugly, I agree. But the white version of the Super Slim, it's actually a really good looking console. If you haven't seen one, check it out.
I just bought one right before we started recording.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
You bought a white Super Slim? Well, good choice, because they're beautiful.
So GameStop, which is our, of course, in the States, that's our retailer of choice for used stuff. Because Amazon, I actually bought a PS3 from Amazon warehouse, which they'll actually take in trade-in stuff and then they will sell it. And I was like, every time I buy stuff from Amazon warehouse hardware wise I'm always blown away by how terrible they are. Like, first they sent it in a box that was like 4 times the size of the PlayStation 3 with like a piece of paper. Like it wasn't properly packed. Like it was shaking around. Like, you know, I was amazed that it actually worked when I turned it on. But when I did, it actually smelled like it was going to catch on fire. So whoa. I quickly unplugged. Like after 30 minutes, it actually smelled like something was burning. So
that's not good.
No, it's not good. And it was like the middle version. It was the original Slim because I thought that what like that was kind of like the best looking one. Today GameStop is doing, if you buy a used console, and this is, if you guys hear this today, go to GameStop.com and buy some stuff, because if you buy a used console, which could be all the way down to a $50 DS Lite, you get two free used games that are $20 or less. So you could actually get two $20 games plus a DS for $50. A DS Lite. Yeah, not bad, because I also do have some, you know, there's some good titles. Like you can get, was it like Infinite Space? Like there's some really like actually somewhat rare DS games or PS3 games. And even you can get like Resident Evil Revelations on the Switch for $20. So you can get that for free with a couple consoles and stuff. So I ended up biting the bullet. I ordered a 500 gig white PlayStation 3 Super Slim, which is, again, from all the revisions, I must believe is going to be the most reliable and the coolest running of all the, you know, versions of the console going forward.
It probably is. I actually don't have a lot of experience with the Super Slim, but I've been using the middle tier Slim one, whatever that one is, since 2009 when my original Fat died. So it's been, that's a pretty good run. It still works great.
It's a great run, and it sneaks up on you when they were posting this week that it is the 5-year anniversary of the PlayStation 4 reveal. I'm like, are you serious?
Oh,
has it
man.
Really been 5 years since that was announced? Like, God, time is just going extremely fast. But then we look at the PlayStation 3, and it's like 12 years old. So it's getting to about that time where if you want to start picking up some of these games that are a little bit on the rare side, or even that aren't even that rare right now, but they might end up getting a following, considering the only way you're going to be able to play these games on the PlayStation 4 is through remakes, or it's okay, but PlayStation Now is not the optimal way to play a lot of these games.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not a big fan of streaming like that.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I mean, it works in a pinch, but it just doesn't look right or feel quite right. And you don't really own anything.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's yeah, not my thing.
Well, this is the thing that I'm worried about, is because I had amassed a huge, and this is the thing, like I hate, okay, I understand people like getting digital stuff. It's very convenient. But the conversation I want to have with, like my friend CJ over the Player One podcast, who buys everything digital from the 3DS. He bought everything digital in the 3DS and the Switch and the Wii U. Eventually, those servers are going to go down. Eventually, you're going to be, you know, SOL when it comes to wanting to play your complete. Or what if like your hard drive dies?
Gosh, I mean, honestly, going all digital on a Nintendo system is the riskiest, craziest thing. I mean, if you do it on an Xbox, I mean, Microsoft's been pretty good, I think, about retaining access, it'll probably be fine. But if you're doing that on a Nintendo machine, you're right. Just asking to lose all of your investment.
Right. Which again, I understand like it's convenience and it's something you won't need to deal with for a while. And you know what? We could all be nuked into like oblivion tomorrow, which all those things can happen. But for me, like if a game is super important, like I still have like extra copies of Dragon Quest V on the DS, like games that are really important to me, I just want to make sure I have a copy in case things happen. And also, we don't have to go down this. This isn't supposed to be a digital versus physical discussion, but I don't like to hold on to games that I'm never going to play again. So I would rather get some money back for them if I want to sell them. So
that's true. But I did just pick up a copy of Dragon Quest V based on your post yesterday, by the way.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean,
I don't own it. And I was like, you know what? I've never played that one. And everybody says it's great. God, so
it's so good. It's so good. It's like one of the, it's probably the best time travel story told in games.
Wow. Okay. That's excellent.
And I know Chrono Trigger is great, But the way we talked about storytelling with Half-Life, and this is why, like, I'm gonna keep bugging the hell out of John Riccardi. He's always this guy. the dude never sleeps. He plays Dragon Quest, not Dragon Quest. He plays Monster Hunter all day. Monster Hunter all night. Works all day. But like, this is, I think he was the reason why I played through Dragon Quest V, because it was like a discussion they had like years and years ago, or maybe he was just having it on Twitter. I'm like, all right, I think I had just finished Final Fantasy IV on the PSP, best version of that game, of the best Final Fantasy game. And I'm like, all right, I think I'm ready for another RPG. And he's like, all right, well, I just only want to play the best ones because I'm not a huge fan, but I'll like them if they're really great. So I played through Dragon Quest V, which when I bought it was not that expensive. It was probably like $22 or whatever, like it is right now. But then the initial print run dried up. So the game was going for like $70, like $80 on eBay because there were no copies of it. But Square Enix has been actually rather good about reprinting games, even old DS games, where they've done multiple reprintings of Dragon Quest IV, which was at that time also like $60 or $70, which Dragon Quest IV is not very good. Same thing with some PSP games, and even like Nier on the PlayStation 3 when Nier Automata came out. They did a reprint of that as well. I don't know how we got down this road, but yeah, physical games are great. So that's why I like to buy them.
Hey, it's nice to own the games that you actually care about and be able to revisit them when you like. You know, you don't need to keep everything, but if you really care about something, it's nice to have it in your collection, especially if you have the room.
Yeah, and those servers are going to be shut down. Like, getting your virtual console games on your Wii, if they're not on your console, like, what is it? Like, in the next couple months, like, those servers are going down forever. So your investment disappears forever. But yeah, on the PlayStation 3, I mean, not only did it have like really great physical exclusives, but I want to just make sure I download all of my digital purchases on a really good, very good to great condition PlayStation 3 to make sure I can have that stuff, because there are a lot of games on both the PS3 and the 360 that came out on Xbox Live Arcade and PSN that never, you know, made it to the backwards compatibility on the Xbox One. Like, God, what's the game that I'm thinking of? It's like Rogue something. It's like a dual stick game where you're in a vehicle. There's multiple characters and there's different power-ups that you can get. Do you know? And you're in a jungle.
Oh,
it was,
man,
made by the Just Cause folks.
Yeah, the Just Cause guys. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean, but I can't remember
Operation,
the name.
No, is it Operation something? Anyways, I got this PS3 that was on fire. Like, you can go back through your download list. And I'm like,
Renegade Ops.
There you go. Awesome. Renegade Ops. Oh God. Awesome game. And like, I've been itching to want to play that. And just like, again, we were talking earlier in the show about listening to old episodes of like One Up Yours, where I'm saying, oh yeah, that game was totally awesome. And I never played it. I want to go back and pick up a copy of that, or even there's just so many games that I got purchased through sales digitally through PSN that I want to have. And games like Yakuza 5, that was only available digitally. So if I want to ever play Yakuza 5, unless I want to wait 10 years until it's remade, I'm going to have to play that on a PlayStation 3 and I need it downloaded. So
yeah, that's right. That's a shame that it's digital only, but still, yeah.
Oh, and there's like weird thing, like Yakuza 3, only physical, was never available digital.
Oh, that's right. You're
so
right.
So if you want to play Yakuza 3, which also I bought a copy of Yakuza 3, because I don't know what took so long. I know you've always checked out the Yakuza games. Like, you did preview videos of Yakuza Kiwami when it was coming out in Japan. But it really took to Yakuza 0 for me to be like, all right, I get it. I got it. This is an awesome
franchise.
Yeah, I think
Zero might actually be my favorite. I really, really like the story in that one.
I even feel bad. I played through Zero and then I put it on the shelf for a couple months. And then I recently started going back to it because I started seeing people talk, because people are still picking up Yakuza Zero. Like, it's been a great word of mouth game. and to hear people talking about these mini games, and I'm like, what? I totally missed that. I missed all these side quests because I was so like adamant. It was because Yakuza 0 came out the same time as Nier Automata and the Nintendo Switch. So it was a terrible time for video games in terms of just like you were trying to blow through everything.
Too much.
It was just too much to play. So I'm looking forward to going through. I guess I'm going to have to wait to Kiwami 2. But I definitely want to play 3, 4, and 5 because 6 comes out in April, man.
Yeah, that's right.
Have you played 6 at all, the Japanese version?
Oh, yeah, I've played a little of 6. I haven't had time to dive into that too much, though, but 6 is pretty good.
It's weird.
And in fact,
Go ahead.
Is the one that made the jump to a brand new engine as well. So, like, just that, it changes the way it feels, like, atmosphere-wise in a really good way. Like, suddenly the world feels more realistic than it ever could before. It's hard to explain, but when you play it, you'll see what I mean. It's like, oh, yeah, this is incredible. Just like the atmosphere that they've created from this new version.
I hope so because I'm an avid. I ordered the Mario Odyssey soundtrack this morning from Amazon Japan because it's finally about to come out. But the Japanese video game audience is always weird, especially when it comes to reviews. So I got a little worried when I saw like it averages like 3 stars on Amazon Japan for Yakuza 6. I think it was because of the story, or it also lacked the depth in terms of having lots of side stories and mini games like the previous versions. Because, like you said, new engine—that's where a lot of the work seems to have gone.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, I could see that issue. Like I said, I haven't had a chance to dive in as deep as I'd like, but you know, that's a good thing.
So, anyways, PlayStation 3. Awesome console. It seems like we can agree. Like if you're going to go for one, go for the slim or the super slim. And
yeah,
I would, if you can, I would go through GameStop because the best thing about GameStop is, I mean, it's not a great organization. But if you have problems, you just bring the console back in and you can literally just keep opening up boxes of consoles until you find one that you are very
exactly.
happy with. So that's why retail stores are great. What are there any games on the PlayStation 3 that really stand out to you as like, this is a game I want to make sure I have forever, games that are kind of like hidden gems on the console that never really, you know, made it to that were like either exclusive or just like are not getting the remakes, like all the God of War games and Eco and Shadow of the Colossus?
Well, one that comes to mind first, it's kind of a weird one, is EX Troopers. From Capcom. Oh, yeah. I mentioned that because it was kind of like, it was a Japan only release, a little bit obscure. Doesn't really seem to be.
Came out on Vita too.
I know there was a 3DS version.
Oh, you're right. You're right. That's what I'm thinking.
Which was a different game in a lot of ways, but,
it was a very impressive 3DS game though. Very impressive.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's cool. And I actually like that EX Troopers more than the series it's kind of based on, which is Lost Planet. I think it's more fun and it's got a cooler style to it than any of the Lost Planet games have.
And so it's soundtrack. Awesome soundtrack.
It's excellent. Yeah.
I have it literally right on my computer right now.
It's good stuff. Yeah.
I know a digression, but it's a shame that like the reason for never bringing that out here is because of like the hard coded like text that is in there. They couldn't really copy over that. It's not like as easy as deleting the text. They're gonna actually have to like almost recode the whole game, so it never came to
I heard that too.
Yes, here it is. Yeah,
that was sweet.
This is a sick track. Listen to this. That's like when you're in like the lobby, like in the headquarters before going on your next mission. Oh man.
Oh yeah.
And it's a game that you can totally import for the 3DS and it's like pretty straightforward. Like I played it without any Japanese knowledge. So
yeah, for sure. It's quite good for that. Another couple that I would say that I really liked was Puppeteer.
Yeah. It's a
very, very weird little platformer game that kind of just slipped under the radar for most people, but it's absolutely beautiful still today. And it's actually the very first game I ever analyzed for Digital Foundry. So it's kind of like, you know, that's where my work started there with that specific game for some reason, just by chance. But I'm a big fan of it. I liked it a lot.
So I'm trying to think if there are any Valkyria 3D, Chronicles too.
3D Dot Game Heroes.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, my God.
That game
God.
Is sweet.
Zelda with voxels, right?
Zelda, yeah. Exactly.
That game is also really expensive right now, I think. I'm going to have to look. I might see if I can see, like, right now is when GameStop has their PlayStation 3 titles at their lowest. Like, it is, it kind of hits a, like, a bell curve of, you know, an inverse bell curve in terms of being inexpensive, where then these games will start getting expensive again and they will get harder and harder to find.
Yeah, I'm wondering about that, but I think you're right. It'll probably happen there as well.
Oh God, it's only $15. I'm totally getting a copy of that.
Of what?
3D Dot Game Heroes.
Oh yeah.
And there's a copy locally, even better. Wow. Thanks, GameStop. It probably won't have a case, but it will be a disc.
Exactly.
I'm trying to think if there's anything. I mean, you got a shelf behind you, right? I was going to say, you got to
hold on. Look.
I've seen that shelf behind you. I mean, there's so many. There's a lot of digital games as well that I can't seem to think off the top of my head, because a lot of like big stuff like Journey got re-releases.
So I'm looking through everything here real quick just to see if anything stands out. Well, you got to get that Haze. No, I'm just kidding.
No, you don't.
Don't play Haze. That's bad.
You know what? Haze is like doubly terrible because it is the reason why we never got Time Splitters 4.
That's true.
So screw Haze.
All right. I mean, it's not my favorite in the series by all means, but Metal Gear Solid 4 is an interesting one because I don't think it was ever released digitally. And it's not been released on any other system besides PS3.
Thank you. That is a fantastic call. And I think I would love to do, I mean, this is the 10-year anniversary of MGS4 as well. I don't want to say it. Well, it's Patreon, folks. It's probably going to get Ryan Payton because obviously of his direct involvement with.
Oh yeah, that'd be amazing.
MGS4, but
he's like burned on the disc there with the podcast episode. That's hilarious.
Exactly.
I love it.
it's almost like this would be a really weird thing to do, but to do like an episode on like the One Up Your Show, because like that was my podcast back in the day, and it is how I got introduced to folks like Ryan, and of course like now you know, Mark and John and Shane and all those folks and Garnett. So I was even like, this is totally just personal, but like it was so weird on Twitter. Like I've been on a panel with Garnett at PAX. And I've like gotten to at least do a podcast with Shane, and like got to meet Mark and John Riccardi, but not John Davison. But yeah, like it was just like I've no shame in saying like it's been really cool to meet those folks.
Yeah, for sure, man. I used to listen to that too. Great stuff.
What else is there? God, I'm gonna have to. Yakuza 3 is getting harder to get because they did a reprint of that, but it was a. It was like a retailer exclusive printing.
That's right.
So there's like new copies, but they're $50.
There's it's a little unpolished, but if you know people are into Yoko Taro games, then Drakengard 3 is on there.
A little unpolished.
Okay, it's a technical nightmare.
How about Nier 1?
Yeah, the original Nier is actually solid enough.
Okay. Like at least like the original Nier you can pick up for like $20. So you can get a copy of that. And I don't know, like, did you play through the original Nier?
Yeah. I liked it.
Something like, I think Nier Automata is maybe my favorite game of last year. I think I
can it was really
that.
Good. I
it's
agree.
Like either that excellent. Or Yakuza Zero. But like, is that something like even Nier has some technical challenges?
It's not technically amazing. It's all right. I mean, it runs fine. It's just kind of ugly and plain looking, but it kind of fits the story a little bit, you know?
It does in terms of like, oh, I don't want to spoil Nier Automata. Never mind. What else? Okay, so this is a good list. I'm making a list of games for you, man.
So MotorStorm series I think is great.
Oh yeah, Pacific Rim, especially Pacific Rim.
That is the one.
Is it Pacific
Rim? Is it Rim or Rift?
I think it's
no. Pacific Rim is the movie.
Yeah. see, this is great. Like, we are workshopping a PlayStation 3 episode. Yeah, MotorStorm Pacific Rift, $16. Okay, $5 at GameStop. That's worth five bucks.
There's a little game called Rain that came out late in the system's life. It's kind of a Team Eco-ish game. It's like a puzzle game where you're only visible when you're in the rain. It was a really weird, like, evocative experience that I quite liked.
I totally forgot about that game, but I own that digitally.
That on disc.
Wait, that what was it in Japan? It got a physical.
It only came out in China. And there may have been a Japanese version, but there's a Chinese version that has full English and everything in it. So I got that on disc because, you know, it was nice to own that.
This is a question. Do I buy a brand new copy of Yakuza 3 for $50?
I mean,
like, used copies are 40 bucks.
Brand new. I mean, that's essentially like just paying original price.
I know, but
which isn't that bad. It's like, all right,
inflation.
You're just paying, you know, you're paying $50 for a $50 game.
Well, it's not like they're going to reprint the game. I bet if anything, if I like needed to resell this in the future, it will probably end up getting more expensive anyways. I'll charge it to the Ficast Network. I'll charge it to my podcast company.
What about the extremely bizarre El Shaddai?
I don't know if I would put that on the list.
I don't know if it would be on a list, but it's one of those weird games from that generation. Okay, I know. I really liked Armored Core 5.
Was that actually released in the States?
Yeah, I think. I have a European version of that, actually. But the Armored Core on PS4 or PS3 started off rough with Armored Core 4.
It came out on 360 too.
Yeah, the frame rate on PS3 was bad, but by the time they got to 5, which I think I don't know if it's on 360, but by the time they got to 5, they kind of had really figured out the tech problems, and it's a lot more polished, and it's a pretty good game, and it's got a really striking art direction, I think.
I mean, it's also, like, this is part of the discussion. Maybe I should just do, like, I mean, I have one of the outlines that I put together for the show that I was talking about before is a three-part series on the Xbox 360. A lot to talk about there. It's 13 years old. But you could do one of the episodes is literally just before it came out because of the marketing behind it, the MTV special.
See, that was a weird one for me because that is the year when I was in Japan living. So they had they actually built a lounge for Xbox 360 near Shibuya. It was this
the big
beautiful
machine, right?
Cafe, and it was this giant cafe, like a bar and everything, and drinks, and they had giant plasma TVs mounted everywhere.
Ricardi there?
I met him from the school across the street, because their office was across the street, but we were there. We went to the launch
you're
together.
You're in the video from the 1UP show, right? Or you were at that thing?
I was at that thing. I may have been in the background, actually, but...
I was totally
there at that crazy lounge thing. And it was like, it was just like, you could just go there before the system came out and just like plop down on one of their big couches and just play 360. And I was like, this is awesome.
Can't wait to play Final Fantasy XI.
Well, they had Ridge Racer 6 there, Cameo. I mean, a lot of the games coming out at launch.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk about this. Like, I can't remember what their big title was for Japan, because obviously Blue Dragon wasn't ready. Oh god, 99.
That wasn't launched, but I remember we actually we all went to the launch together and we were asking some of the people in line what they were getting, and the most common answer was like Tetris. There was a version of Tetris for the 360 at launch. It was either Ridge Racer or Tetris was the most common response. I was like, all right, you're buying a 360 for Tetris.
Here's some more PS3 games as I was looking at my list. There was Wipeout Fury. There's Wipeout HD.
In Europe here, they actually released HD and HD Fury together on a disc.
That is awesome. That
as
is
well as
hard to get.
Another European-only release that I have here is Siren Blood Curse.
Oh God. Yeah. They released that in episodes, right?
It was per episode digital downloads in the US, but over here and in Japan, they actually just released the whole thing on a disc. And that's a lot more convenient because each episode is its own download.
Right.
Normally.
Right.
But it's a great game.
There's the MGS collection, the HD collection, which is really great.
Oh yeah. That's a excellent collection. You're right.
Unfortunately, it's good to remember that the PlayStation 3 actually does a pretty good job of upscaling PlayStation 1 games.
It's good. It's great for that.
It's better than hooking up a PS1 at least.
And it runs them faster than a real PS1.
Right. Like the only reason I have a PlayStation Vita TV is because it was $40 and it plays PlayStation 1 games. What else is there? Tokyo Jungle, of course, is a really cool game that's on there.
Oh, yeah, that's pure craziness.
There's so many great games on the PlayStation 3. Like, it ended up being a hell of a console for such a rough start that it had.
Oh, yeah. It's a good machine now, but you're right. It had a pretty rough start.
Let's see. I'm trying to... we don't have to ramble on about that stuff. But, yeah, that's maybe I'll do that. Like, after I'll do the... Maybe we'll do the summer of 360 or something like that. I think that would be fun to do because it is the 360 was just such an important console. Like not that maybe the Wii at some point too, but I think even more than the PlayStation 3 or the Wii, like the 360 just set the stage for so many things that were now going to be expected from any future console, both online and from the accessibility of the content too.
Yeah, for sure. It's pretty important.
All right. So, man, that was 30 minutes. That was a 30-minute Patreon segment. That was a lot longer than I thought it would be, but that's what happens.
That's how it goes sometimes.
That's how it goes sometimes. But actually, I got to run. I got class in 20 minutes.
Enjoy your Japanese class, man.
But
sounds great.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you to everyone that has listened to this because that means you're a Patreon supporter of the show. So thank you so much for supporting Back My Play and helping me make more episodes. Hope you enjoyed the extra segment. We will see you next time.